kind of just return. I'm gonna just do a little review. We're made for love. We're made from love, by love, and for love. And so the whole notion of like the challenge of our life then is this: is like, how do I live that way? How do I live this actually from love and come, you know, made by love, made from love, and made for love? Living like you have a destination. That's one of the huge things. Is again, once I understand what a human being is, then I get happiness. Because like Nick said, when it comes to that whole idea of like the archer having a target, if I don't have a target, imagine going out and practicing bow and arrow shooting with no target. I mean, like literally no target. Not like, now I'm trying to hit a tree. Now I'm trying to hit a squirrel. Now I'm trying to hit a car. Like, not, but no, just no target. Just kind of like all I'm doing is just this action. How meaningless would that be? But what is revealed to us in the church is through Christ is this, is that there's a target. Another way to say it is this: if you're made by love, from love, and for love, that means you have a destiny. And destiny is not fate, it's not like you're locked in. It basically means if you have a destiny, it means you have a destination. Like there's a goal. There's a purpose and a plan to your life. And so the whole idea is, it's not just like wandering around and saying, well, I hope I end up somewhere happier than I started out. But it's the idea of saying, there actually is a place that I can be shooting for. There is a whole image or vision for life that I can be trying to live. And what we're talking about today is, here's the church saying, here's Christ saying, and through John Paul II, saying that the vision for your life is this: you're made for love. To love, which is another way to say, you're made to be a gift to someone else. Maybe you're made, in fact, to be a gift to more than just one someone else, but meant to be a gift to your family, to your friends, to everyone with whom you're in a relationship. We talk about this. It's not just about sex. Every human relationship, which is why you could say even like the theology of the body applies to the workplace. Not because... Never mind. Because I'm in a relationship with those people. How can I not just use them? How can I actually love them in the most appropriate way? And this is what we're going to be talking about today when it comes to love.
And again, I'm the one who always harps on this, but you can only do this in the body. The way we live now, you're not going to do that naked. You know, that'd be the optimum, you know, in the workplace and everything, but I work at a church, so. But it's always going to be in the body. The body, it's the only way. It was established. It's the only means to attain this love we're aiming for. It's the only means to show love to anybody. It's the only means to relate. Your body is the only way to have communion. It alone makes visible the invisible. The body is you. The body is your person. So you, as your whole being that God made you, you're a spirit-body composite, and the only way you can learn this love, the only way you can experience the love of God, is in your body. We talk about how the flesh is the hinge of salvation. The only way you can experience salvation is in the body. Exemplified by how Christ, the only way He worked out, the only way He chose to work out salvation was in the body. Because the body means something. Therefore, because of this, again, everything you do with your body matters.
And the whole thing is story. We talked about the story of Adam. He's alone, original solitude. He made for someone else. There she is. They're both naked, without shame. This whole notion of this is the purpose and plan for my life. And then there's that fall and that broke and that fundamental brokenness, that fundamental disquiet and the temptation to use. On top, I think, of your outline, there's a quote from John Paul II. If I'm not mistaken, I would like to see that. Thank you. Here's John Paul II. He says, if the person who does not decide to love forever will find it very difficult to really love for even one day. I've talked to people, and I've shared that quote with them as we jump into the second talk, who have said, no, that's ridiculous. The person who does not decide to love forever will find it very difficult to love, really love for even one day. One thing to say about that is there's a key word in here. Decide. Sometimes we have this notion like, no, love is something that happens to you. Like acne or gas. Like I couldn't help myself. Here's Pope John Paul II. The person who does not decide to love forever. You actually
This should be freeing for all of us. If you want to have a love that lasts for your entire life, what do you have to do? I'm just going to wait. It's going to come to me. Well, maybe you might have to wait. But when the opportunity arises, then you just choose. You actually get to decide. Well, the person that I'm planning on marrying, or the person I'm married to right now, will that last? Well, if you decide that it's going to last, you actually get to choose that. Which, again, it's not up to the flip of the coin. It's up to your choice. I've decided I'm going to love you forever. I'm going to love you beyond just right now. I'm going to love you beyond our 30s. I'm going to love you beyond the struggles we have in our 40s. I'm going to love you beyond our kids leaving the house and us trying to figure out how we love each other. I've decided. We both decided this, we're going to love each other for the rest of our lives. And you get to actually make that choice. With God's grace, you can make that decision. Super, super good. Super good. The other thing is this. A person who does not decide to love forever will find it very difficult to really love for even one day. Why is that? I'm recently talking with this guy, and he's graduated from college, and a couple years now. In college, he's a really good-looking guy. I can say that. He's a really good-looking guy, and really athletic, really just kind of like, you know, it's kind of like really personable, total package type thing. And in college, 3 nights a week, he'd be able to, I mean, this is him telling me, he'd go to the bar and just be like, okay, that one. The next night, okay, that one. Next night, like, that one. And this is how we just lived college. And then, summertime, he'd go wherever, you know, where he's home, wherever he's from, do the same kind of thing, just regularly, whenever he went out, and just kind of, he knew, that I'd go off, go to a certain bar, I'd be able to pick up essentially any girl that I wanted to. I mean, right? Within reason. He starts having kind of feelings for this one woman in particular. But we're meeting because he's like, I don't know what to do with this. Because I want this to be more. He had this thing in his heart, like the insatiability of the union. It's not enough for me to just kind of pick a new girl every whatever. Or just have you date someone for 2 weeks and then just kind of use them up, move on. I want something more, but he's like, I don't know how, I literally didn't know how to do it. Because he just trained himself not to love anyone, where he had the reverse thrusters, you know, the rocket was supposed to be going one direction. He trained his entire life, the rocket goes the other direction. My life, I'm made to pour myself out. What I've been doing my entire life is I've just been taking from every girl that I know. And so God starts to think like, this woman though, she's different. He actually likes her. The other girls, he didn't like me. I like how you look. I like how you make me feel. But this other girl, he's like, I actually like her. But he's talking to me. He's like, I don't know if I can, like, give. I don't know if I can actually love her. Why? And it's kind of one of those things where, like, because, dude, you've never loved a woman. I mean, the question is this. You have a sister. You have a mom. Do you even love your sister? Do you even love your mom? The sense of, if I've been living my life, even if it's not someone who's been sleeping around, but someone who just, do I live my whole life as in it's all about me and my life? As opposed to my coworkers, how are you, what do you need? My friends, not just at convenience, but when do you need? If I find it, if I cannot choose to love forever, then I'm not going to be in love for one day. And that's experiencing this guy's life because he's been using every day and now he finds it very difficult to even turn those thrusters around and love. But that's the plan. And that's actually possible.
Jump to Christ talking, and he's talking to disciples and he says, if you've heard it said, I think you have it, I'm sure you have it in the scripture, but you've heard it said, thou shalt not commit adultery. That's, you know, one of the Ten Commandments back at the way beginning. They knew that one. You've heard it said, thou shalt not commit adultery. And in my life, that was always a given. Like, I grew up, I didn't want to be any of the marriages I saw around me. I didn't want to be what I saw lived out. I wanted to be different. So I always knew, I will never commit adultery. I'll never do that. But Christ doesn't stop there, because that's just addressing a surface issue. Yeah, you've heard it said, thou shalt not commit adultery. Much like he says, Moses gave you, you know, the certificate of divorce because of the hardness of your heart. He goes deeper with it. He finishes the sentence by saying, I say that if you even look after a woman with lust in your heart, you've already committed adultery. When I was going to Bible college, those words were terrifying to me. For every guy in this room, you can understand the idea, don't ever actually physically commit adultery. Because I can do that. I can just choose to never do that. But God, you don't know my mind. You don't know what I'm dealing with. That's not going to happen. To not look lustfully at any other woman, that's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. So those words bring condemnation. So, in much the same way for women, like, lust, because it applies to everybody. If you ever even think of somebody else as an object, you've already done that. So, where does that leave us? If this was anybody else saying these words, that would leave us condemned. And we would walk, we should just go home now, walk past the donuts, because we can't even eat now. Just walk home and I don't know what. Just watch Channel 10. For the rest of your life. Because what else is there? If this is the state we're in, well crap, I'm up a creek. Then we don't, if that was anyone else saying it. But it's Christ saying it. And when Christ says something, it can't bring condemnation. Because he never condemns us. Because his love for us is so great. That whatever comes out of his mouth is only redemption. It's a lot like if we were in like this 100-story building and we're on the 99th floor and the whole building is in flames. And we're trapped. And I'm running around screaming, we're in flames! We're going to die! Then I'm an idiot and I'm not making anything better. Right? I'm not, do you have water, Nick? No, it's just there's fire! Right? If it's me saying it, I'm doing no good whatsoever. But if we look out the window, out of one of the shattered windows, and they're like floating as Kal-El. You know, like Superman. And he's like, you guys are in a fiery building. Okay, well he can offer hope, right? We would look at him and say, alright, jump, grab, and just slow me down. That's what we would want. When Christ speaks to us, and this is something that we all make this mistake, we interpret Scripture through our own filters of whether it's sin or insecurity or weakness. When God talks to us, he's not the tyrant that the devil would like us to believe. No matter what we've done in our life, literally, no matter what, I would say, if I murdered the world, and I was standing on top of the pile of bodies, and I turned to God with all of my heart, his love is so great that he could fix that in me. He could forgive that. No matter what you've done in your life, the words of Christ here, they bring hope. They bring redemption. They bring peace, not condemnation. Again, if it was anyone else, they wouldn't. But because it's Christ, then he looks into your life, into your lust, into your sexuality, and he says, yeah, but I can bring hope.
But wait, Nick, this isn't me. Because I'm really horny.
Too much information, Father.
But it doesn't matter. Because John Paul II says, a readily roused sensuality is the stuff from which a rich, though difficult, personal life may be made. I think you have this quote. He says, a readily roused sensuality. So is the church saying, like, ignore sensuality? No. He's saying, actually, a strong, passionate sensuality is the stuff from which a rich, though difficult, personal life may be made. The church, Christ looks at you and says, I'm not telling you to not have desires. The church doesn't look at you and say, stop looking. Christ looks at you and says, I'm not asking you to stop looking. I'm asking you to go deeper with me. I'm asking you to open yourself to me and let me show you what healing looks like. In Galatians 5:18, it says, if you are led by the Spirit, you are not under the law. What Christ is saying to you is, follow me, follow my Spirit, because I want to take you deeper than laws. Because we all know that laws, in and of themselves, do nothing to change your heart.
Because if that's what it was, in Matthew 5 is where Jesus gives that. He was heard it. You have heard it said X, but now I tell you X times a million. Thank you. The first one, if I got that down, like the Ten Commandments, if I had no problem, like, okay, bring it on. Give me something new. No, whatever. But that's not the case, right? We look at the Ten Commandments and it's, what the heck? I can't even do that. And now you're saying if I look at someone lustful and commit adultery, you've heard it say, thou shalt not commit murder. But I tell you that
Even growing angry with your brother is a sin. What the heck? I can hear that and just gets me really discouraged because, like, what can I do? The reality, though, like Nick said, is that it's because it's Jesus saying it. And he does not just tell us the building's on fire. He also gives us a way out. This is really important for us to understand that Jesus didn't just give us more rules to follow. He didn't just come to give us more rules. He came to give us a new heart. Didn't just come to give us new rules. He came to give us a new heart to actually change us. And that's why Nick had said like that, not saying, don't look, but look deeper. And so there's a sense of what we call, he came to change our ethos. It might be the word might be there in your outline, ETHOS. God came to change our ethos. And what's an ethos? Well, if someone were to come along and say, like, kind of like, don't do that, you're like, yeah, but I want that. Your ethos is this, it's your inner world of desires. Like, inside you, without anything else, what is it that attracts you? What is it that you just, in yourself, you just are repulsed by, or repelled by? What are the things that kind of like, they direct your heart? What's the deepest desire of your heart? That's your ethos. And then this is interesting. I remember I was in seminary, and there was a guy who taught moral theology to us. Married guy, and he has, I don't know, 7 or 8 kids, and he told a story about, he was walking by a movie poster for the movie Striptease with Demi Moore. And this is the poster, I don't know if has her legs or something on it. And he's walking down the street, but with a friend of his. And this friend said, man, that movie, like, I can't believe anyone would even want to go see that. And our moral theology professor is like, yeah, I can't believe anyone would even want to see Demi Moore on screen with no clothes. He's like, oh, yeah. You know, because why? Because he's on, this one guy has his ethos is like, I don't even want that. But my moral theology professor is saying, okay, I know that I shouldn't want that. But my inner world, my ethos is like, oh, beautiful woman, you know? Jesus came not to just give us new rules. Don't look at that. Jesus came not, don't go see that movie. Jesus came to say, actually, I can change your heart. I actually can shape it. So what you desire is not just to see, we're going to talk about pornography today, not just to see Demi Moore's naked body. What you actually desire is to see this woman whose name is Demi. And be able to see the man sitting next to you and see this man who's really here. And that's like to change that ethos. I actually desire not to use them. That's a reverse rocket thrusters. I desire to really see the person right here. So what does change the ethos look? What does that look like? Jesus still has these rules. And you might have heard this. Mark and Ann, you are getting married, correct? When is your wedding date?
June 4th.
Excellent. This year, right?
Yeah.
Great, fantastic. So Mark, you love Ann?
Yeah.
Good, Ann?
Yes.
Good. Mark, do you need, so you're getting married June 4th, do you need the commandment, thou shalt not murder your fiancé?
Be helpful.
Okay, that's great. Actually, do you desire to murder Ann? Okay. You don't need to wait. So you don't desire to murder Ann?
Correct.
Do you need the commandment, thou shalt not murder your fiancé? It's not necessary, right? Even if it's a good thing to not murder your fiancé, you don't need that commandment. This is the ethos. Here's Mark, who actually loves Ann. Therefore, the commandment, which would be good, thou shalt not murder your fiancé, is like, boom, flip. Doesn't matter. Because he doesn't even desire that. His inner ethos is right along the line of the gospel. And imagine, there's so many commandments, things that are bad for us, that none of you desire. Your ethos is already right in line. We already experienced that. There are a couple other examples.
Yeah, I was Whole Foods Co-op. So I walked out of there a couple days ago. I always felt weird when I leave because I'm not a hippie, but I left. We still shop there, but I guess I'm not a hippie. I was walking out, and there was a wallet and gloves there. And it was full of money, and there was a checkbook in there. I had no desire to steal that. I didn't have to be like, oh, who's it looking? You know, like, do they have cameras? I picked it up and brought it in because I don't need that law. That's what I'll steal because I don't desire to steal.
But even in society, sometimes the things are you do desire. Like, you know, I don't need the commandment, thou shalt not watch Saw 17. Because, like, I've seen enough of Saw to know, right, to know that I don't want to watch this violent movie. Although, it would be helpful, maybe someone would need that, right? Someone would say, actually, you know, you shouldn't, these movies really violate the dignity of the human person. I used to really like violent movies. In high school and early in college, like, so the guys would get together and watch this, like, really violent. And someone had to, you know, kind of, I had to be spoken to my heart. Not just someone saying, actually, you know what, you shouldn't watch that. But I had to have something in me that started, I actually saw four, I think, or whatever it was, one on TV. And it was kind of one of those, like, ugh. I don't desire that. It was easy to turn off. But I remember a day when I didn't want to turn that off. When I would have been like, whoa, oh my gosh, I can't believe that. What does that mean? Hope. It means that if my ethos right now is when it comes to relationships, when it comes to other people, I desire to use people. And you're like sitting here going like, you mentioned pornography, you mentioned like using your boyfriend or using your girlfriend, and you're like, oh, I'm stuck in that, I really want to. Well, hope. Your ethos can change. It changes all the time. When it comes to violence, when it comes to humor, when it comes to balance and humor, like, I guess I still fail when it comes to, I still love watching failblog.org. People falling down, just type in that into your YouTube search or Google search, it's the best thing ever. But maybe I shouldn't desire that. Maybe my ethos, I have some friends who they'll watch that humor, I think it's humorous, and they'll watch it like, oh. Like, thumb up. But what I should be saying is, oh, maybe I shouldn't, like, I have this image in my head, like, but they got up. I don't know if they got up. Well, the person next to me sees. I see some random guy, you know, jumping on the diving board and having to break away. I'm like, wah! What they see is, that could be my dad. They see a person. I see, you know, that girl stopping grapes. Walls over and like, oh, 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 oh. Like, oh my gosh. What if that was your mom? You know, that sense of what if my mom fell on her head? I still need a lot of change.
Yeah.
What if there was a person, but a person, right? Not just a thing, a person that was meant to be loved. It ceases to be as funny.
Yeah, and on a deeper level, like, when it comes to even, like, attractions, like, physical attractions, you may, guys, you might have a sister who is beautiful. My sister, I was hoping she'd be here today so I could do that, but my sister is gorgeous. My sister is a beautiful woman, or your lady's your brother, you might have a brother that's just a really handsome guy. And you can recognize their beauty. No one thinks it's weird that I would say my sister is a beautiful woman, because she is. But there are those who would take that to a different level. If you take that to a sexual level, to a level that is wrong, it's inordinate, then that kind of person would need a law. I don't need a law against how I view my sister, because I view her correctly. I have no desire to view her inordinately. But if you're a person, and if your heart desires something that is off base, that it shouldn't be, that is harmful for you or for anyone else, then there is a need for the law.
And that's the thing, is if we have a desire to abuse our freedom, I want to abuse my freedom, then we have a need for that freedom to be restricted. But when it comes to those whose desire is actually to love the person, then we realize that the minimum demands of the law, this is a quote from Pope John Paul II, the minimum demands of the law are not enough. It's not enough to say, like for Mark, if you really love Anne, just get through the rest of your life without killing her. Show her that you love her. Like, Mark would be like, okay, that's all I have to do. Or Nick to say, I can get through the rest of my married life without having an affair on my wife. That's all I have to do. But Mark, if you love Ann, and Nick, if he loves Jacelyn, love doesn't stop at the minimum demands. Love says, what more can I do? How much more can I give? And Adam, in the garden, wasn't enough. Wasn't enough for him just to say, like, I can talk to you all about how I'd love to defend you, how I'd love to guard you, how I want to protect you.
if I really loved you, what I'm going to do is I'm actually going to step out and lay down my life. And the end of that quote from Paul II has, it says, on the other hand, those who are impelled by love feel an interior urge not to stop the minimum demands of the law, but to live them in their fullness. This is a still uncertain and fragile journey, as long as we're here on earth. Because some days we do well. You know, those of you who are in a long-term relationship, or you've been, you've all been in long-term relationships. You all have parents, I imagine. Relatively long-term. Siblings, maybe. Relatively long-term relationship. Sometimes you do it really, really well. And sometimes we do it not as well. Still fragile on this journey. But here's the hope again. It's one made possible by grace. Grace is God's light, it's God's strength, it's God's power. Even if you experience brokenness, this whole idea of giving your life and living your life is actually possible, and it's made possible through Jesus Christ.
And through the grace of Christ, if you ever heard of Philip Yancey, there's a book called What's So Amazing About Grace, and there are good aspects and bad aspects to it, but one of the neatest things I thought in there, he has this analogy of if the way we treat God and rules and like him allowing grace to come into our life is often the way his analogy was if a man and wife, you know, had saved themselves from marriage, and on their wedding day, you know, they go through the whole ceremony and the reception, and then they go up to the hotel room, and they get into bed, and they're about to, you know, consummate their marriage, and the man says, okay, wait, just for, hold on, I want to be here, I love you, I'm in it, you know, for the long haul, but I just was wondering, how far can I go with other people and still be okay with you? We would say that there's something fundamentally wrong about that, in that. Because he would be looking at not the center of the relationship, who it's about, but he would be looking at the boundaries, the laws, and because in that analogy and because in our lives, because we are inordinate in some ways, we need those in the meantime. We need the boundaries. We need the Ten Commandments. We need something to let us know, okay, where's our bumpers? Like in bowling, I always need the bumpers. Like, so we need those. But through Christ's grace, we can turn our gaze from outward inward to the center of the relationship, which in all things is always going to be Jesus Christ. Even in all of this, we're seeking to find Christ and His love for us. Even in our physical relationships on earth, it's always about Christ. But the thing is, we're in a situation right now, and I think, Redemption of the Body, you have this Romans 8:23 quote, that we groan inwardly as we wait for the redemption of our bodies. With all of this, there are two mistakes you can make. Because this, I don't know if you're anything like me, you start to hear this and you're like, yes, that's what I want. I want my focus to be right. I want everything to be in line. I don't want the bumpers. I want to bowl like a free man. Like I want this. But there are mistakes we can make in it. First, we're not there yet. There's the already not yet. In the Christian life, when Christ came and brought the kingdom, we're still. Would any of us say that this auditorium is heaven? No, we're not there yet. We haven't attained. And not even like we die and go to heaven, but like the ultimate attaining of like when we get reunited with our bodies, the resurrection of the body, when it all gets cinched up at the marriage supper of the Lamb. We're not there yet. So in the meantime, as we run, we have desires that linger. And we submit them to Christ as often as we can. We strive for everything. But we have to have, first of all, the patience to know that it's a process. We're not there yet. The other mistake is to think that our redemption is all in the soul. That it's, you know, when Christ came, He came in the body, yeah, but He came to redeem my soul and to forgive my sins. All the while forgetting, like, no, it's not just that. When His ultimate plan was body-soul composite staying together, it's the wages of sin that rips them apart, the body and the soul. So when Christ came to forgive sins, He came to bring about redemption in the body as well. This is theology of the body. So the hope is for you guys that whatever darkness that might be hiding in there, and you're like, I hope He doesn't talk about that. Or like, I hope we don't have to, I'm not going there. All of that darkness in your body, in your bodily life, He can bring that to light and bring that to healing.
This is possible through two things. Grace and effort. Or grace and discipline. Or you might call it grace and grit. It's all possible through grace and grit. But it takes both. This new heart, this new ethos, right? What attracts me, what repels me, what I want to go away from, it's possible. And just while we're talking about this, if you get the sense, ever get the sense of like, I don't see that anywhere. This new ethos of people actually wanting to love and staying away from use, I look at all, like Nick said, all these relationships. I even look at people who talk about the theology of the body, and they don't do this all of the time really well. And we can look at this in this example. We can start getting disheartened. And one of the examples is this. I've heard someone say, we're all in these cars, and every car you've ever seen, every car you've ever driven, all have flat tires. And so we're driving along the road, and everyone's car, we all have flat tires. You ever try to drive a car with flat tires? It's very, very hard. You can't go as fast. You can't go on the same kind of terrain. It's just, it doesn't work as well as it's supposed to. Imagine, that's all of our experience, though. Just flat-tired cars. And then someone comes along and says, well, actually, the secret is, in the beginning, there was air in the tires. Like, you drive, every car you've ever driven has been like this, but it's not how it's supposed to be. And it's possible to get air back in there. Like, wouldn't that, at least the idea, be kind of exciting? Like, wouldn't even the idea of that give some kind of hope? Is that really possible? And the truth is, yes. It's true, it's possible to reinflate the tires. Be able to drive in a way that's like, that's freedom. And that's the gift, that's God's grace, is reinflating the tires. Now, at the same time, again, there's always these obstacles, that the traps we can fall into. One is to say, that's so hopeless, that'll never be me. Honestly, I don't even have rubber on the tires. Like, it's on the rim, and those are bent. Like, this, that'll never be me, that's one trap. And that's actually not true. God's grace can do anything. The other one is to say, like, that's totally already me. I totally know what you're talking about. Whenever I look at my Playboys, I'm always thinking, oh, beauty! No shame! No, that's not it. So, you know, saying, like, oh, I totally love that you're talking to the theology body the other night. Like, I was totally thinking about it. I was making out with my girlfriend, and we're doing stuff. I'm like, this is so good. Not exactly. We can fall these two traps of being like, that'll never be me. And the other one is, that's already me. And I'm fully redeemed. Therefore, I can do anything. Because I have the right heart. Like, I'd say, maybe not. The question is, are we fully ready for that? Grace is necessary. How do we get grace? Well, it's a free gift of God, but...
So, if grace is necessary in both situations. In the heart that says, I can never do this. And I know in a lot of, especially, like, I talk with a lot of women, and, like, you have that in your heart, this, like, depth of insecurity, like, no, I'm just, it's not possible. I don't think I could ever view myself correctly. Or others. Men. I know men feel that. Like, it sounds good, but what you're saying, I can't hit that. I can't imagine. I need a new brain for that one. Well, that's what grace brings. So you need grace for that situation. And for the other situation, they say, nah, I'm already there. I got it. I understood. I went to the day conference. Okay, I got it. Like, you need grace for that as well, to understand humility, to understand where you're still messing up, where you're still going to fall. You need grace to go really, really deep in you. And John Paul II said, there are three, if you want to, is this in your outline? Is this part of it?
Yeah.
Those words? Oh, okay, good. The three infallible, indispensable means of grace. One of the neatest things for me, like when I became Catholic, was, because I was always about grace. That's what I preach. Anytime I got a chance to preach, I would preach on God's grace. His grace is bigger than anything. And that's true. And then I started reading into Catholicism. And the way they talk about grace, like every minute is grace. Every breath is a grace. Like, God's grace is everywhere, constantly wanting to be pumped into your life. It overwhelmed me. And so John Paul II is talking about, in all the mistakes you've ever made, there are three infallible, indispensable means of grace. Infallible meaning they can't fail you. These will not fail. Indispensable meaning you can't succeed without them. He sums it up by just saying, if you want to succeed in this life, if you want to change, if you want redemption, to thrive in you and to create you a new creature. Three infallible ways. And they are on the sheet, prayer, confession, and the Eucharist. Prayer, spending time with God. Prayer is turning your heart toward Him. That's intimacy. It's like my relationship with Jacelyn. Like, we need to spend time together. And not like once a week. Like, I want daily time with her. And the more I know her, I can't fathom, we're talking about because our 10-year anniversary is coming up. I can't fathom what I felt about her before compared to what I feel now. It was love, but it's nothing like what I feel now and what I have for her. because of how much I know her. So prayer, spending time with God. Confession, I love this because he talks about, here's an infallible way to succeed in life in Christ. Written into this infallible way is failure. When you fail, which if you're anything like me, by the time the day's over, I'm an idiot. Well, what do you do then? If I'm an idiot, what do? You run to forgiveness. You run to Christ and His grace. We call the confessional the sin bin. You just drag yourself to the sin bin and say, look, here's what I did. Change me. And you know what He does? His grace is so infallible that every single time that you turn to Him, He says, alright, good. I'll take that. I'll put goodness there. I'll put grace there. Every time. I've got a confession twice in a 24-hour period before. And the second time, Christ wasn't be like, you again? No. At least 48 hours. No, it's okay. I'll take that. I'll give you grace. So prayer, spending time with Him. When you mess up, it's okay. That's covered. And then the Eucharist. We'll learn more about the intimacy of the Eucharist. But that's really the groom and the bride becoming one. Him at every Mass turning to you and saying, like, no matter what's going on in your life, no matter what, I'm physically here with you. Because what matters? The body. Because how do we show love? In the body. So Christ, in His body, says, nope. Every single time, I'm here. Doesn't matter how attentive you are at church. It doesn't matter how ready you are and how into the readings you are. And if you love chant, if you go to St. Ben's, it doesn't even matter. It doesn't matter. I love you enough that if you come here, I'm waiting for you physically. I will be with you. I will become one with you. So the three infallible means of grace. If you want to overcome any of the insecurities, and my struggle is more like the arrogance. Like, no, I got this. I teach this. I know it. Like, to overcome all of that, what do we need? Prayer, confession, and Eucharist.
Because even though grace is real, we still have to do something with it. Yeah, God's grace is completely free. We've got to do. We have to use it. The great example I came up with it, so probably it's awesome.
It's great.
But the example is this. Grace is my parents, after I was a terrible, terrible child, they, in the middle of the summer, there's no holidays, there's no reason, they say, Michael, here's a guitar. It's a gift. But yeah, I just got done throwing a tantrum. I'm a jerk to you guys. I feel like you're being your son so often. No, here's a gift. It's just a guitar. Complete gift, complete grace. And I can take that grace, that free gift I did nothing to deserve. I'm like, that's awesome. Look at this thing. Take it and just put it there. Awesome. Free gift, total grace. I am now a guitar player. And I rock. No, because I'm just leaving the guitar there. So there's grace, and I've got to do something with it. Or else it just sits there. And so there's got to be grace, but also some effort, some cooperation. I'm going to take this free gift, and I'm going to actually play it. I'm going to take this free gift, and I'm actually going to use it. When it comes to theology of the body, not just a gift of like, here's some knowledge, because I can know this and not do it. But it requires a commitment to keeping the tires inflated. And it's not just a one-time decision. You can't just be like, yep, done. I'm going to never use, I'm all because I'm going to love. Pope John Paul II, another quote on your handout, says, those who seek the fulfillment of their own human and Christian vocation in marriage are called, first of all, this is why all the people in marriage prep, I invited you to the evening, you're called, first of all, to make the theology of the body the content of your lives and behavior. Everything you do as a married couple, this should be the core of the theology of the body, should be the core of absolutely everything you do. And what is that? I'm here to pour myself out in love for you, to not take, to not use, but to just lay down my life for my bride. And that balance, that notion of we're free, but we also still need redemption. But being free, like, what does it take to be free? What does it take for me to be able to be able to see those people who just can pick up a guitar and then they're just like, bum, bum, bum. You know, they hear a song just like that. They hear a song on the radio and they're just like, wait, this, oh yeah, this is how it goes. Why are you? Or someone does ever have that feeling? I sometimes have this feeling where I just want to walk over the piano. And I want to, I've seen people do this. My little brother can do this. And he does that after Sunday morning mass at Newman. He goes over and just like sits down and just like starts playing Sense and Sensibility.
was like going on and I'm like, that's so cool. It just seems like it flows out of his hands. I'm like, I'm going to do that too. But I wanted to. I just wanted to flow out. Why can my brother sit at the piano and play whatever he wants, whenever he wants? Why is my brother free? Because for hours after school, every single day, he sat at the piano and he played the notes as they were written. Because he can be free now because he had been disciplined first. I recently watched this movie on Netflix. Two thumbs up, way up, called Surf Wives. If you've heard of it, it's a documentary about this guy. He was a doctor, became a doctor from Stanford, so pretty bright guy. And then he started life as a doctor, he started his adult life being a doctor. Then he realized, I don't want to be a doctor. Like, I don't fit in the system. I want to be a surfer. And so that's what he did. He became just a surf bum, and then he married this woman, and they lived in a trailer, and just drove all over the country. And they had 9 children, 8 boys, 1 girl. And the whole documentary is like, how awesome was this? They had this, you know, like eternal summer kind of thing going on, where they just surfed everywhere. All these kids, and they're just like, blah, 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 you know, and the kids were like, yeah, we never had to go to school. We never had, like, other kids that had to, like, learn all this stuff. We read all the time, but we didn't have to sit in the classroom. We didn't have to get our degrees. We didn't have to do all these things. And it was just kind of like a celebration of, like, we just got to be, like, instead of like savages, you know, like my dad, our dad had this image of like unrestrained freedom, being so good. Like if animals do it, that's how we're going to do it. Actually, this guy was so committed to this. He once went to the zoo and he saw these animals that would eat around the skin of like an apple. And so that's how he said, if the animals do it, that's how I'm going to do it. So he never ate the skin of an apple ever again. These kind of things. If the animals do it, we do it. So I saw him raise my kids. If the animals do it, then we're going to do it. They don't go to school. They get to run free. Get to be this animal. That's how my kids are going to be. And it was kind of just like, that's awesome. These adults now are interviewed, and they're like, yeah, all of our friends, they were so jealous. Like, you guys don't have to go to school. You get to surf all the time. They did. And they became actually world champion surfers for a little while you get to be a world champion surfer. And at the end of the movie, though, it was like, hey, where are they now? You know, they're giving this whole interview, all 9 kids. And it's like, well, yeah, I wanted to be a doctor. I applied, but it went to high school. I couldn't be a doctor. Someone says, yeah, I wanted to be a whatever, but I had no formal training in anything. So I couldn't be that. And I had no, these kids who were like, you can do whatever you want. But actually, no, you can't. You can only have freedom because you first had discipline. This is true on the piano, the guitar, in just life. So he used a doctor who's like, he had discipline, therefore he could give that up to do whatever he wanted. But his kids had nothing. Therefore, all they could do was, you can serve. You can be a bum. But they couldn't choose because there was no discipline. Same thing with Christianity, with following Christ. I've been given a gift. I've been given grace. If I want to have freedom, I've got to start using that grace. Have a plan and use it actually in a somewhat disciplined way. Now, of course, we come here, this is the last thing I'll say before handing back over to Nick. You can come here and you can hear like, okay, so Father Mike and Nick, they taught us how to, you know, this is a... lovely. I know how to play the piano now. And we can hear T.O.B., right? And be like, I got it. Don't use love. Check. And like, I know how to play the piano. And then you get in the situation where, okay, now we're adding the left hand. And now we're adding some syncopation. And now we're adding a pedal. And it's dark. And it's late. And I really love her. And I'm getting horny. And what do I do now? It gets more complex. I get the basics. How do I live this out? Discipline and grace meeting and giving you guys, giving all of us freedom.
So the balance is that, again, addressing the part of you that feels like you could never do this. Like who would look at, you know, Maddie Schmitz, who can just sit down and play the piano so well, and say, like, no, I can't. I could never do it. I just don't have the discipline. I'm an incredibly undisciplined person. And so I would look at that and say, well, no, maybe I could, but I'm not going to. Like, I can't do it. That's too much. We can look at the woundedness. We can look at the depth inside that we've gotten to, some of the darker points. and said, I can't do this. But here, what I want to say is, so I first saw porn when I was 8 years old. The average for a male in America is 7 right now. So, and that's the average. So, that is where I began learning what relationships look like. That's the only reason I'm glad my mom didn't come today, because she's never heard that part of the talk before. But I was 8 years old. I began formulating my views on relationships, sexuality, on love, at 8 from that. And it just kept stockpiling all my life. Till I looked around until my parents got divorced. Till my real dad, I never knew until I was 18 because he was an alcoholic and abusive. And you start realizing all these things and you go so deep that you're like, nothing will ever change that. I know, it sounds great, but nothing can change that. What I want to say is that I'm not the same person that I was 3.5 years ago. I was 6.5 years into my marriage and I was ruining it. Because I couldn't view things correctly. I didn't know how. It wasn't that I was trying to be bad. I didn't understand how to look. I didn't get it. And I was a Christian all my life. I would go to purity weekends where we had, you know, you learn all about why not to do it. Like the whole keep it in your pants thing, which is great. I wonder if God had said that to Adam. Like, what are pants? I don't even get it. Anyway. I would go to the whole weekend and we'd sign the card at the end and you'd wear the purity ring. And the things I would do with my girlfriend with the purity ring on that Monday night showed that something inside was a disconnect. And I had gotten to the point where that's never going to change in me. My wife and I were just to the point where we're never going to see eye to eye. This will never heal. But the cross of Christ, if Christ is who he says he was, then his redemption, his suffering on the cross, and his resurrection from the dead can change you. And I was at a Bible study one time, way, way back when we first heard about theology of the body. And I was telling like what I had heard. I had this outline. I'm like, and it says here that redemption can, and one of the guys in the room was like, yeah, but at the same time though, Nick, some people are just wired differently. You know, some guys are just, I mean, that's good for you. You seem like a really good guy, really pure. But some guys, referring to himself, obviously, like, nope, some people are just too far. And I looked at him like, wait, are you really saying you're the one guy in history that Christ's redemption on the cross can't reach, can't transform? If Christ could raise people from the dead, and if Christ could heal the lame and the blind, and if he could raise himself from the dead, then he can look into your heart and he can shine his light of love, of real love, and he can transform you and change you.
And there's nobody that this can't touch. What does mean though is that we need to have certain training. Like, so it's great to have like, here's some ideas and concepts and abstract thoughts. But what can I do? Here's a couple things. To train yourself to look in a certain way. Now again, that involves training, but to train your eyes. Now again, for guys, a lot of times the idea is like, when I look at a woman, I train to assess, kind of like look at her body. What I do is I use a woman for my own pleasure. I take in like, okay, just take another look. Hope no one saw that. Okay, busted. I was just picking something up. Girls, I'm saying weird. You're oftentimes, it's not necessarily lusting after a guy in the sense of, let's say lust, like, you're like, check him out. Oh, check out the buns on that.
Yeah, he must work out.
Anyone? A dollar, if you know what movie that's from.
I'm a dollar.
Okay, good job. But for women, a lot of times it's, I just met this amazing man, and he just, like, is so incredible. He's got this, and I can completely see it already. We're married. This is our house. Our kids are like this. They look like me. I'm like him, and our dog actually looks like the three of the two of us, too. And, like, this whole notion of, like, I just met this person. As you're having this conversation with him, it's not like you're like, check that him out. It's more like, I want to marry you and spend the rest of my life with you. And here's what it's going to look like. That what's happening there is, for the guys, it's, here's the girl. I'm just breaking her down to her parts. Girls, it's, I meet this guy, and I'm breaking him down to, here's, I'm not looking at the person of him, this other person. I'm looking at this imaginary thing. It's funny how often we just don't see other people as other. I was doing marriage prep with this couple, and they were a month before they were getting married, and this guy was sitting on my couch with his bride, and he was like, I have to say this. I am so excited. I'm like, okay, what's going on? So we had this discussion the other day, and I realized she is completely different from me.
Like, she's someone else. Like, yeah? No, he's like, I always thought because we love each other, because we like the same things. So she thinks completely differently than I do. I always thought, I just assumed that if I think this, she thinks this. She's got her own brain. Yes, that also, that comes with them. Every model has one. Like, that someone other than me, that I can't just reduce to their parts, and I can't just reduce to how they make me feel, or who I feel, what I feel like around them. And what we call to training. So the training is this. If I'm a man, as a man, I want to break down a woman into her parts, and maybe that temptation is this. Next milliseconds. Can you say that?
Sure. It's a childlike way that Nick describes it. But when the church isn't saying get rid of attraction, the church is saying, and I have to break it down to millisecond number one and millisecond number two. Like these quick moments of time. So when my wife first walked into the room, when I had this audition, when I first saw her ever, she walked in, and millisecond number one, I didn't set out that day to say, when I walk in that room, I'm going to find one girl attractive, and it'll be her. Like, she walked in, I was like, whoa, I can't stop staring. Like, it was instinct. Millisecond number one just recognized beauty. And so for you guys, like, please don't. Christ doesn't actually have to go in and transform millisecond number one in the same way you might be thinking. Because I want that moment through all eternity. Like, I'm glad that happened. I'm glad Christ didn't change that in my life. So millisecond number one is when you recognize beauty. Whether that's you look at a guy and you're like, you know, he's the one for me and we're married. Like, that first, like, oh, he's marriage material? Awesome. Guys should be marriage material. Men, when you look at women, you're like, wow, she's gorgeous. That's great. You should be able to recognize beauty. Millisecond number one says, wow. Millisecond number two says, come here. Millisecond number one just, it's instinct that recognizes, well, I'm attracted. Millisecond number two is where you turn the person into an object and you say, I think you're pretty, so satisfy me. That's the Elvis song. Baby, shut your mouth and open up your heart and satisfy me. Like, what? My wife would be so mad if I dissed Elvis right now because she loves Elvis. But that song specifically. Like, what? You suddenly the woman who is beautiful is just an object for me. And vice versa, the same way that you look at men. Like, they cease to be that human being with his own brain, smaller though it may be, I don't know. But his own brain and his own life and his own dreams, and they just become what you can get out of it.
And so this sense of, like, where's true purity? Purity of heart. Jesus says in Matthew chapter 5, verse 8, so blessed are the pure heart, for they shall see God. And the quote, I think it says, mature Christian purity offers the ability to see God's mystery revealed in the human body and in man and woman's call to communion. And imagine the scene. Imagine being able to recognize, like they were saying, the ability to see the mystery of the person in their body. When you look at someone and you see, like that groom who loved his bride, say, when I look at bride, I get it now. She's someone other. And he's like, I want to spend the rest of my life trying to find out who she is. They're recognizing there's an attraction there and there's a beauty there. And I see that revealed in the body. There's a story that it's an ancient story. It goes back about this. These two bishops and this prostitute. And the bishops were coming out of, it's in Europe, ancient Europe. And the bishops were coming out of the cathedral. And just as they were coming out in the procession, this well-known prostitute of the city walks by and she was dressed pretty scandalously, like provocatively, like a prostitute might be, and one of the bishops, you know, he saw her coming. She was well known. He looks away. And the other bishop, his name is Bishop Nonus. He looks right at the prostitute. He gets, you know, scantily clad, dressed provocatively, just staring at her as she walks by. And the one bishop who looked away goes to the other bishop and says, you know, brother bishop, like Bishop Nonus. What are you doing? Look away. And as Bishop Nonus looked at his fellow bishop, he had tears in his eyes. And he says, it is just a shame that kind of beauty is sold to the lusts of men. And in that kind of situation, here's one bishop who says, like, listen, I can't handle that. Here's a guy who's like, I shouldn't be looking there, because if I look, that's what I'm thinking. How can I use this girl? The other bishop, though, that's fine. If I'm there, I have to do that. That's not the goal. The goal is the second bishop, who says, I can see the beauty of this woman. I see past. I see the mystery revealed in the body. So when he looked at her, he didn't want to use her. He saw this woman who was worth loving. The true story. The prostitute. She noticed. As she walks by this cathedral, the bishop's coming out, she actually noticed the one bishop is staring at her. And she was used to be staring at, she was used to it. She was used to be staring at by men. But there was something in his gaze that was different. And later on, she sought out this bishop. Who is that guy who looked at me? No. Bishop Nonus, where is he? She went up, she found out where he was. She talked to him. She said, I've never seen a man look at me the way you're looking at me. Why? And he told her why. He told her about the truth about Jesus, the truth about her worth. Truth that she's worth loving, she's worth dying for, and she's not worth being used ever. She came to give her life to Jesus. And she died, her name was Pelagia. She died, her name is, now we call her Saint Pelagia. She died a saint. Bishop Nonus is now Saint Nonus. Here's the deeper gaze, right? It's not just about look away. Not just about don't do that. It's about look. But look deeper. Look more clearly. Don't just see the parts. See the person. And when it comes to pornography, that's what we're going to kind of be talking about a little bit, is there's a quote by John Paul II on your outlines. It says, here's the problem with pornography. It's a big problem. But he said the problem with pornography is not that it reveals too much of the person. You know, exposing the image, they're showing us too much. He said the problem with pornography is that it reveals too little of the person. That it makes me stop at body part. And I don't see personhood. That the person in the image is reduced to their sexual organs and sexual faculties and is thereby depersonalized. Brother again. He and I were at a bachelor party, some of his friends, and round about and went to this bar, and apparently in the basement of this bar they had exotic dancing, one way to put it. And it was exotic Brainerd, I guess. So we went to the bar, the upstairs was normal, and I guess I went into the bar. They're like, hey, we're all going downstairs. I'm like, I'm not going downstairs. I'll just play pool while you guys go sin. And so, I was playing pool with some of the other guys who didn't want to go down there. And then maybe 5-10 minutes later, my brother comes up. And he's been married for a while. His oldest daughter at that point. She's a couple years old. And hey, Mark's up. He's like, I had to take off. I'm like, why? Why? What's wrong? It's like, I don't know, I was just down this place, and at one point, I heard one of the girls say to the other girl, hey, Madison, come on over here. His oldest daughter's named Madison. And he was like, ah. And all of a sudden, this thing that was there for him, was all of a sudden, wait, she's got a dad. She's someone's daughter. And he saw his daughter in her. He said, I am in the wrong place. I've got to go. Pornography reduces the person to parts. How do we restore that? It's not just by looking away. It's by looking deeper. It's by saying, okay, this object is not an object. This is a person. Okay, girls, it's not just he's just a great guy that I can do. No, no, no. He's just a great guy. Whether he's there for you or not there for you is irrelevant. But to look deeper and see the mystery of the person is how we get free. That's what Pope John Paul II, the Sistine Chapel, you probably heard of it. On the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel by Michelangelo are all of these naked people everywhere. It's a church. Naked people all over the place. Pornography. Like, people love the Sistine. But actually, over the course of years, what people did was they would actually, they painted loincloths over the naked people. Because, like, for Pete's sake, this is a church. You don't need to see naked people all over the place. When Sistine Chapel was restored about 15 years ago, Pope John Paul II said, actually, when you restore these, take the loincloths off. Because, whoa, because the Pope's into porn? No. Because he said, what? The body reveals the person. And the body's meant to not incite... So porn is meant to incite lust. How can I use this person? Nakedness, that art, was meant to say, oh, woman, there's a man. There's two beings, persons, in the image and likeness of God. So good. And that's the problem with pornography, is reduces the person. That's why I was at a talk once, and this guy named Father John Harvey was giving a presentation, and he showed a cover of Cosmopolitan magazine. And he said, he held it up and said, this is pornography, you know. It was the cover of Cosmo. Like, well, like, Father, she's got clothes on. He's like, don't be deceived by the fact that what she's wearing. He says, look at this picture. Look at her look on this picture. The image, the photo, how it's placed on that cover is not meant to reveal a person to anyone. That picture, that image, is meant to incite lust. Does that make sense? So, like, there's a difference between here is just naked figure, and here is even partially clothed figure, but you get that sense of, like, actually what they're trying to do is they're trying to make us lust. Another priest had said, when it came to this whole issue, he was an artist. He said, when he was 17-year-old, he went off to college to become an art major. He said, is it possible? Do you guys think it's possible for a 17-year-old man, 17-year-old boy, to look at a naked woman and not lust? And I'm like, no. He said, it is. I'm an artist. And I would go into these studios and I'd be drawing and there'd be nudes. But he says, it was my goal here is to capture the person in this painting, in this art, to express the personhood. He could have said, I'm looking at this naked person for my own personal lust. But he ended up showing us these two pictures. One was of this painting of this woman at the wash basin. I think is the title of it. She's washing clothes. She has no top on, painting. And she's washing clothes in this basin. And this other picture was, I think it might have been Keira Knightley or someone like, look at Keira Knightley. And I'm going to act this out. Nick, could you act this out?
Oh, no, I was just clearing it for you.
Okay, thank you. So, here's this model, and she has, like, a tennis outfit on, so tennis skirt, and sleeveless, whatever, and she's got her one leg up, I don't know if I can do this, and she's got kind of, like, this whole kind of look, so she's, like, holding down the skirt, just right here, and this kind of thing, and she says, which one is pornography? And the idea would be, like, you say, well, the one with the naked one. He said, no, look at the naked one. What's the art do? And he said, no, where does your, look at the picture, where does your eye go? He said, your eye, this woman is holding this wash basin, it's painting. And your eye starts with her eyes. You get drawn in by this woman's face. And you go around her arms, come up, and you go back to her face. What you do when you look at this art is you're taking the whole person. You see this whole human being. You don't just see boobs. It's like, person. He says, look at this other picture of this, you know, this totally, we'd all see it and go like, don't be so prudish. She's got clothes on. He says, but look how they set up the photo. He says, hey, look away. Now look at it. Where do your eyes go? And he said, he's like, he's funny because on her face, she has this look of not just like, hey, what's up? It's, hey, what's up? So he says, you start with her eyes, but you don't stay there. Says the whole image, the way that's all the. He's like, I'm an artist. I see these things. We unconsciously do it. The aesthetics was you do this thing where you take your eyes and go, and you basically go right to her crotch, and that's where your eyes rest. That's where that stops. Is you see part. See first sultry, seductive eyes, and part. It hides her. I don't see Kira. I just see her parts. And that whole notion of what's the intention of this image? It is to break someone down to parts. If it's meant to incite lust, then we call that thing pornography.
It is not about how much skin do I get to see. It's about why are they showing me this? So I can see a person or so I can see parts.
And the flip side is that Pope John Paul II, you have it in your outline, talks about masters of suspicion. And I'll just read the quote first. Redemption does not magically remove the consequences of sin in this life. We still suffer, we get ill, we grow old, we struggle with weaknesses and the pull of lust. Yet the reality of sin must not cause us to hold the human heart in continual suspicion. The point is that, and I did this as a guy, I was so far gone, I assumed everyone else is that far gone. I couldn't look at people correctly, so then I would assume that no one was looking at me correctly. I was talking to somebody recently and they were like, this guy I dated for 4 years, he kept me clamped down. I had no freedom because he was afraid that I would cheat on him. She said, I couldn't talk to anybody. I couldn't go to the store without being like, well, who'd you talk to? Who'd you see? What'd you say? Because he was continually in suspicion, but not because of any of her behaviors ever, but because of where his heart lay. And so with us, we can't become that. We can't allow ourselves to do that. John Paul II says, even that's true. Even though that we still struggle, we still get old. We struggle with the pull of lust. It is a fight. It's a battle. It's a battleground. But all that, we have to look at it in the light of Christ. That we can never let ourselves get to the jaded point where we view all of ourselves and all of humanity with a light of suspicion. We have to look actually the opposite. As well as ourselves, we have to look at everybody as in being completely possible to be healed. Never too far gone to be in the reaches of God's grace. Because that's what His grace offers. When we fall down, we have an infallible means of grace. When we're standing, we have an infallible means of grace to keep us standing. And it's the redemption and the love of Christ.
And the very last thing we'll say before our lunch break is, goes back to this. When we have a training, yes, there's a training of the eyes and training of the heart. But we know that it goes deeper than that. It goes all the way to our hearts. I just want to talk in this last couple minutes about the number one lie that's come against men and come against women. With the fall. Go back to the beginning. Here's Adam and here's Eve. Adam got his job. Eve knows her love, knows her work. And there's the fall, and there's these lies that come against. And I want to say, generally speaking, with almost every person I've ever spoken with, there's one lie that's come against women, and there's one lie that's come against men. And the lie that's come against women is this. And it's a voice maybe, a word, a sentence, a saying you've heard maybe every day of your life. And it's this. You're not worth loving. That you're not lovable. That you're not actually worth dying for. You're not worth living for. And so this is one of these things. Even if it's just a doubt, am I lovable? Am I worth loving? And so what's the response to that? Well, the response to that is, well, then I'm going to make myself lovable. I'm going to make myself worth loving. I mean, that's how, and you probably know this, I don't have to tell you guys this, how much of life is spent trying to be different than you actually already are. Here's how my hair is, but it shouldn't be this way. I should look like this. Why? Because ultimately, at the core of it, then I'll be lovable. My face is this shape, but I'm going to accentuate this and de-accentuate this. Why? Ultimately, at the core of it, because then I'll be lovable. I'm this shape. My body looks like this. But I've got to look like that other person. Why? Because ultimately, then I'll be worth loving. And that's the one lie that's come against every single woman I've ever met. I don't mean to put my stuff on you. I'm just saying, I just found that to be the case. Every mom, every daughter, every sister, every girl. Is that this fear? I'm not worth loving. The lie that's come against men is a compliment. Brothers, we probably know this. The lie that's come against us is the temptation to say, is this true? The word is this. You don't have what it takes. That you're not enough. That you're not competent. The question is this. Am I a man? Am I the man I'm supposed to be? And so where, in the beginning, where it was, this is the reason why I build skyscrapers and sing love songs and fight dragons, was for the other. It's now become, I build skyscrapers to make up for my own insecurities. I was giving a talk at one of the a more kind of wealthy one of the suburbs down in Twin Cities a couple weeks ago, and I mentioned this to the guys. So guys, we know this. It's not about just driving a car. We have to drive this kind of car. Why? Because that means I've made it. I can have that kind of car. Well, yeah, not just get a job. No, I've got to get this job. It has some kind of a sense of superiority, some sense of accomplishment to it. Why? Because if I don't, then I don't have what it takes. And so men, our life is spent not fighting for someone else. It's fighting against this lie that I don't have what it takes. I am not competent. I'm not enough. I'm not a man. And I'll say this. When it comes to speaking against that lie, this is training you guys. We know this, and we can do something about it. Men, think about every woman in your life. Think about maybe the one woman in your life you love more than anyone else. A sister, a friend, a daughter, a wife, fiance, mom. And if this is her, the lie that's coming against her, what's your job? She thinks, like, I'm not lovable. Your job is to say, I'm speaking against that lie. With everything, with your words and with your actions, I'm actually saying you are lovable. You're worth loving. That's why I say, men, if you're called to be dads, then there's no one other than you who can speak into your wife's heart like you can. To tell her, actually, no. What Adam said, here's one at last worth dying for, that's you. You're worth dying for. Not you change, not you different, not you better. You right now. Man, that's your job. If you have children, you have daughters. That's your job. Because no one can speak into a daughter's heart like her dad. There's so much woundedness. Why? Because dads have failed to live up to their call. Dads have failed to lay down their lives for their daughters. They have failed to speak into their daughters' hearts and tell them you're actually worth loving. You ever find those girls, some of you are here right now, who are just so, they have a sense of like, I know my worth. You can guarantee that was because they had a father or a father figure who spoke into their hearts and told them their worth, spoke against the lie and crushed it. And my sisters, if you know this about every man you know, to one degree or another, that he's like, do I have what it takes? Am I competent? Am I a man? Then you get to speak into the heart of the man, the men that you love. How often do we have our dads who are just frustrated? Our dads who are angry. Why are they angry? Because the heart of it is like, because I'm afraid that I'm not enough for you all. Because he knows his weakness. All of our dads, they, to one degree or another, they know their weakness. They know what they're feeling. And they also know that we know. And what's their biggest fear is that they know that I'm a failure. So I drive a Dodge Stratus. What's that all about? That Saturday Night skit. You will respect me. Because that's what he wants. Because I don't feel like I'm competent. So my wife can speak into my heart and say, actually, you do have what it takes. I know your weakness. Donna Reed. George Bailey. The building alone is going down. But you're the one who can save it. George, you just yelled at the children. I know that this isn't really you. You're a better man than this. And my sisters, you can speak into the hearts of your brothers. You can speak into the hearts of the men you love, your dads, and your sons. And that's the training. You can start this today. It's not just about changing our eyes, changing our gaze. How do I speak to the women in my life if you're a man? How do I speak to the men in my life? And what's the word that they need to hear?
You're the man.
You're the man. And you're worth loving. Here's where it comes down to the very point. This is the period at the end of the everything. If you can't come back for this afternoon, I understand. But I will not like you forever. No. But don't forget this. There was a garden where that Adam had a job to do, he failed. And then he spent the rest of his existence, do I have what it takes? Eve spent the rest of her existence, am I lovable? And then in Christ, there's another garden. Not the Garden of Eden, it's a garden of Gethsemane. And Jesus is actually called in Scripture the new Adam.
and he goes into this new garden, and a serpent approaches him, and he's tempted, to run away. He's tempted to not stand and guard his bride. Same temptation. Just stay quiet. Let your bride be taken out. But he refuses to hear that voice. My soul is sorrowful even unto death. Take this cup away from me. But not my will. Father, your will be done. And this new groom, this new Adam, is where the old Adam stays silent and let his bride be taken out by the dragon. This new Adam, he stands fast and he opens out his arms. And he says, you are not touching my bride. He says, you can take me down, you will not take her down. Here's Christ who says, I have a job. I am placed on this earth to cultivate and to guard my bride. You will not have her. And so sisters, whenever you see that crucifix, whenever you see that cross, whenever you see that image of Christ on the cross, the lie that says, I'm not worth loving, look at that. That's how much you're worth loving. Men, when you see the crucifix and you're thinking like, do I have what it takes? Am I confident? You can look at the crucifix and you see Christ and say, that's how much he believes in me. That I do have what it takes. Because here's what he says. Here's what he says I can do. Because Ephesians chapter 5, we're going to hear about the second half of the day. Paul says, husbands, love your wives like that. I can't. No. You can. That's your call. And what Jesus has done with that cross as he's driven a stake into the heart of the great lie. You are worth loving. You do have what it takes. Now live like that. And that's revealed in his body. It's the truth of the theology of the body. Say a prayer. Glory be to the Father, and to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit, as it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. Amen. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.